Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Oh, hell no, we're living in the real gangster shit. Cause when it comes to the real niggas, it makes the shit that much harder to deal with.
Yo, 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 what's up, world? It's badass thugging like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cup. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond.
Bless. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is Cassidy the Hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, man. Easy.
Yeah. Just keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cuff Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
Man, don't change that dial. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that dial. Wait, man.
Bernie Dollars, the Queen of Trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout out to the live show on Friday night, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it is, what it ain't, what it do. To the chill from that original Lynch Mob, and Off the Cuff Radio is always where it's at on Friday nights. West West, y'all.
Woo! Episode 412 is on the way right now. I'm your host, King Eric, and you are now tuned in to the most live and direct show, Off the Cuff Radio, alongside my host T-Max with the facts. Hold on 1 second. Try to bring them on. Hold on 1 second.
What it do, what it do, y'all, man. It's T-Max. Shout out to the head host, King Eric the Ruler. This is OTC up in the building. Monday night, we are sponsored by Buddy Boy Entertainment, Core Financial, Jesse's Boutique, Da Vinci Clothing, King Era Productions, Dirty Basement. Man, this is going to be one of our most exciting, exhilarating, in all things, even educational at a lot of levels, because we got a shock for y'all in terms of what we're doing tonight. The guest we have tonight is one of the most legendary, illuminating ladies born and raised in L.A., doing it her way. This woman right here is behind some of the look, as Prince would say in his song, the look, because for a lot of the motion pictures out there, we're going to get into it. We're not going to spoil the surprises right now in terms of some of the stuff she worked on, but every movie has to have a distinct look. And this woman is responsible for bringing the awesome aesthetic to the big screen that everybody has seen. She's a veteran of the game, so much wisdom, one of the most down-to-earth distinguished ladies, and we are so privileged to have her on. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the lovely, consummate professional, and completely legendary Kenya Ware. How are you, man?
Hold on, we need to bring them on a little bit. Studio taking a little bit.
Okay.
Wall Talk need to get it together, man. We got her on the line.
Yeah.
Hold on 1 second. I'm gonna fix this right quick.
Okay.
Hold on, you still on?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm here. We got her, or yeah, we're still trying to get her in. Okay.
Yeah, we got it. It was a little technical issue I'm having right here. We've been dealing with this off and on all day.
Okay, okay.
She's on.
Okay, can you hear us?
I
hey.
Can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, yes. We want to make sure we got the introduction. Hopefully you heard it and everything. Want to make sure we watched
yeah.
it right.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, guys. It was a pleasure to be here with you guys. Thank you for having me.
Man, look, it was a long
yes,
time
indeed.
Coming, but we made it happen. Yes, yes. So, King, we got to give it that. We got to give it that round of that standing ovation, a round of applause, man.
Man, Blog Talk can get their mind right. Got me looking bad out here. So we just going to go.
Blame it on the weather and blame it on all the stuff that's going on.
There we go.
That's
there we go. There we go. Yeah.
There we go.
Just blame it on the weather and everything else. We gonna still make it through and push through this, right?
Yes, we are.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes,
that's
yes,
what
guys.
We do best.
Definitely.
But yeah, we definitely love the fact that you took the time to join us for episode 412. Welcome to the archives. And you have played a very important role in not only the West Coast film scene, but also the music scene as well. And this is what we want our audience to know. Like, tell us about
yeah.
yourself and let the world know okay. who Kenya Ware is. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So started out my early career, and it's still a part of my career right now, in costuming, costume designer, costuming. Got my start at Death Row Records, kind of toying around and dressing the boys. I look at some of their things, the hockey jerseys, all the college jerseys they had on back in the days, even Snoop's, I think, What's My Name video, one of the videos. And I remember that's where I started just chiming in, bringing in the product placements and calling up all the African-American companies and getting placements. So it kind of my career began at Death Row Records, and I'm still doing it to this day. I'm not turning down no money. If they call me for something, I'm down.
Definitely. And one thing about it, King, you know, y'all, especially being on the West Coast, you know, y'all really influenced, you know, so many styles. Because one thing about it, you know, because we're going to get into your movie career, because you've done some big pictures. You don't want to spoil that because, you know,
right.
your credentials are amazing in terms of what you've done. But in
right.
terms of where we're keeping it right now, in terms of the music aspect, you know, one thing about it in show business, you know, is that going back from when show business started, you know, there was always the look, the aesthetic. It was always you wanted to present something. You wanted it to be representative of, you know, your demographic. And I mean, you know, and I mean, you're a dresser. You know, you are responsible for making sure that, you know, the artists are right. I mean, you know, what was it like during that time? Because, I mean, you know, especially with the West, because we know that the white T-shirts and the jeans, of course, you know, the Lokes, you know, the Carhartt jacket. I mean, pretty much, what was the development of the style in terms of West Coast as the hip-hop really started, and then when it started going into gangster rap, and then from your assessment, how it evolved into what it is today? Because this is just on fashion alone, we could have a 2-hour conversation alone on the fashion trends in hip hop.
Oh, costumes,
I mean,
yeah.
Please, the floor, yeah. The floor is yours,
right.
lady. Let's go
right.
with it. Let's get it.
Well, you know, when you're dealing with the artist, so we're taking it back to '91. You got to kind of channel in on who they are. So we'll take the Dog Pound, and you know, Snoop's his daily dress were already khakis. So, you know, you want to enhance that. You know, you bring it up just a little bit. Daz and Corrupt were his proteges. So they all – you didn't want to take them away from who they were. They weren't going to let you do it anyway. So the khaki, the Pendletons.
Right.
The Pendletons are important.
Right.
But then how you flip it, you start introducing them to the hockey jerseys. And then you introduce them to the Carl Kanai and the cross colors with different colors. And then you introduce them to, like, they had the college sweatshirts back in the day. and you introduce them to that, you still have to still keep their, you know, the khakis, but then piece by piece bring them in, and because you can't, it takes this. It's time. These men have a look in a look that they want to keep, so you don't want to, you know, change up too quick. So I just piece by piece just brought them in, and I mean all the product placement was free. So, you know, you call Carl Kanai. Carl Kanai will come with a truck, a load of stuff, dump it. And we have a fashion show in the middle of Dad's and Snoop's living room, you know. You have all the hockey jerseys. Oh, they used to send us all the teams when nobody was rocking the hockey jerseys. Snoop said, I will. So, I mean, those little pieces like that, that counted. And we were getting all that for them. I mean, product placement was new at that point. Nobody was really – nobody never tapped into the product placement market. And I said, you know what? We have to – we can cross-connect the product with the artist, you know, and, you know, get a big – maybe a deal at the end of the day. No one was doing that. I know – I knew the ingredients at that day. How the product placement – I mean, I used to call myself the product placement queen. I mean – I want to call up all the companies and let them know, hey, I'm doing the Oscars or I'm doing this video or that video. And a lot of them will, for marketing purposes, will get down with us because if that video, think about this, if that video is viewed a million times, then the sales for that shirt or that company goes up. So people were not tapping into the product placement. I was all into that because I was, you know, I was a marketing major at Cal State Northridge, so marketing was very important. And I knew, you know, you have to strategize that. Bring the product in. It's free. But we're doing you a favor because your revenue will go up after my artist wears this. Now, you think about it, a lot of people are, I remember doing a movie, the Entourage movie, and I was just a part of the costuming team. And on that movie, they were charging like a tequila companies like $300,000-$400,000 just to get their product seen on the movie. They weren't doing that back in the 90s. I mean, we were doing our friends favors. So, you know, it's very important to, with your artists, you know, when you're dealing with musicians, let them have a say. So you don't want to take away from who they are. You can't because, I mean, you don't want to get clowned. I'm not getting clowned. So, you know, fashion is still, I mean, I still get calls, you know, for fashion. I mean, Keith Sweat and Bobby Brown called me last month for Verses. And one called me at 1 o'clock in the morning, the next morning. And what did I do? I tapped into all my vendors. I know tons of people who are making designers that are making these costumes. We go to them. We go to our leather vendors. We go to Michael Jordan, the people that we normally are used to dealing with. Jordan's been taking care of me for the last 20 years. I have a great relationship with Jordan Brand because when they were just starting out, I was getting them placed on television shows, so now they show me love 20-some-odd years later.
Okay, before we go further, ladies and gentlemen, this is what I told y'all from the beginning, this is going to be an educational show.
It's a trendsetting show.
This woman is going to tell you about product placement, branding, in terms of the exponential rate that, you know, one thing about it, Kenya, is that when you do this, because I don't think people really understand the level of gain that you're giving right now in terms of it. There was a story one time, and you can confirm this or not confirm what happened. Because I heard at one point the situation, of course, shout out to the late, great Tupac Shakur. Of course, you know, he was one of the, you know, on the West Coast, he was really doing it, you know, wearing Carl Kanai. And I'd heard a story one time where Carl Kanai asked him about how much do you want in terms of you wearing my brand. And Pot was like, I don't want anything. What would I look like charging another black man when I'm supposed to be supporting another black man?
That's true.
So that was a true story. Okay, so
100%. I talked to Carl once a week. Carl is my Carl is one of my best friends, him and his ex-wife, my best friend. And believe it or not, Carl, you've seen Carl on most of the things I've worked on. Straight Outta Compton, Carl, did we had all the stuff custom made for Dre and all the characters that rocked it.
Oh, wow.
The Tupac movie. Carl Kanai is my call. I call him in the middle of the night. Carl would start having the sewers making anything. I bring him in. He's the first. Anytime I do a movie, hands down, and if it's a contemporary movie with clothing now, it's Carl and Michael Jordan. Those are the two people for probably the last 20 years I call first. April Walker, my homegirl out of New York.
Yeah.
Walker Weir, she's one of my good friends. April, too, that's my soul sister number one. April gets love. I channel in on people who had my back then, and I bring them here. So anything I do, the first calls are going to be made is going to be Jordan Brand and Carl Kanai. And then everything else, and if I can get April on there, and then it'll trickle down from there. So, Carl, I remember, I'm going to take you guys back. Most people probably didn't remember this movie, but it was Josh Gimel, and one of his first movies. He was married to Fergie at that point, and he did this movie called Life as We Know It. And him and Fergie were married.
Yeah.
So I did that movie in Atlanta, and me and Josh were friends. So I said, Josh, I need you to do me a favor. He says, what? I said, I need you to rock this Jordan hat in a scene, all right? I'm going to make sure you and Fergie are straight. That dude told the directors, I'm rocking this Jordan hat in a scene. He pulled the hat off and pulled his head into the camera on the scene. Major placement for Jordan. Major. And this is in, what, maybe like 08, 07, 08 in Atlanta?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
things like that, it makes me feel good because my family at Jordan, Charles Oakley, shout out to him. That's my partner there. Those are my partners. That's my my poker partner. Poker partner and cooking. He cooks for us whenever we're in town. He'll cook for us. But the things like that, you get a relationship with these actors and you brand it and you look out for your people because they will look out for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know. If they look up, I picked up Champion. Champion is not my new family. That people they've been around for years, years and years and years. And I just got a major placement on this Showtime show, Shameless, with William H. Macy.
Yeah,
and,
from Fargo and Boogie Nights. Yeah,
exactly. And I worked with them for years on that show. And I made sure all his stuff. Everything had to be broken down to look like it was 10 years old. Nothing could ever look brand new for him. So,
right,
of course, I called in Champion. And Warner Brothers never clears anybody. They're sticklers about product placement, but they okayed Champion. Champion ended up sending 100 pairs of shoes and about 20 boxes of clothes, and I got a whole scene dedicated to Champion on Shameless. That's the hardest thing to do on a major, this is a Showtime show, filmed at Warner Brothers. And the whole scene, all the actors had on Champion shoes. No one can do that. So I'm crowning myself. Product placement is that's still my world because I'm going to always pick up the phone and call whoever. If it's a tequila brand my friend has or if it's a marijuana brand, I'm going to brand it out. I'm going to bring my friends in and we're going to keep this money going together. In a circle. That's what you're supposed to do.
Man, you know.
People don't understand the importance behind that, behind image placement, because it's like one scene could just change your whole look and it could change your whole brand.
Yeah. I found myself a couple weeks ago, you guys. I mean, I always kind of fall in spaces. And it came up about all the fights that are coming up, you know, Mayweather's teams and all that. And I just picked up the phone. I'm like, I'm going to pick up the phone because I know Jordan, he used to mess with the boxing. He used to really be deep in the boxing.
Roy Jones.
Roy Jones. After Roy Jones, he got out. He didn't want to do it. So I'm a young lady. I hit them up about two months ago. I'm like, I think y'all need to get back into the branding. I mean, it's so many good fights that are coming up. I mean, it's a lot of good ones. And the Pacquiao fight, he's fighting some of our friends. Let's get some shorts. And the text I got back was like, Kenya, Michael just said that he don't want to do that since Roy Jones Jr. Okay, so I left it alone. But you know Kenya's coming back. So 3 weeks later, I hit him again. And I get a laughing emoji. They're like, oh, my God. He said, you called 3 weeks ago, and then Pacquiao's people just called just a minute ago. I'm like, yeah, I beat them to the game. Let them know that. Let them know this woman beat them to the game. I said, come on now. I said, I'm always got that on my mind. I always got placements and how we can generate money and turn this into something bigger. You know, it's always been that. So, you know, shout out to all the brands, Carl Kanai, Jordan Brand, Reggie over there. Shout out to all of them for always looking out.
Man, and that
shows
wild,
right there,
yo,
how ahead of the curve.
Yeah,
it just shows how ahead of the curve you was, because even when you did with the hockey jerseys, I never even thought of that. That's like new news to me. And then next thing you know, everybody else start following that trend.
The hockey jersey, Snoop rocked that hockey jersey. It was the gold and black one, Rangers or one of them, and everybody started rocking them. We just were stepping out the box, you know, getting something different for him, because he did not, that wasn't his regular wear. You know Snoop, hockey jerseys, a college sweatshirt. He was khaki, Pendleton, all that. But you just put that little piece in there, and it flips it. It'll flip it, you know. And I was all about product placement. I still am. I mean, I remember, fun fact, you guys, in 1998, I'm behind stage, and it's a John B. concert, Destiny Child. And by this time, I'm working, if you guys have ever heard from Mecca USA out of New York. I was the West Coast marketing rep for them. So I brought all those Mecca to L.A. and was placing it on all the West Coasters, because, remember, it was an East Coast thing when they let me bring it down here. So anytime somebody came to my city, they were going to rock that Mecca. I had Snoop rocking Mecca, Dazz and Corrupt, Mike and Recca, I mean the Mecca, and then Destiny Child when Beyonce was there. I told them, I said, girls, I really need y'all to rock this on stage, this Mecca, these Mecca dresses. Them girls were in the dressing room taking the clothes off and switching the stuff on I brought in there. True story, back in the days. And they, I mean, Beyonce during them days, so sweet. All the girls, so sweet. John B., so sweet, all the time. They knew when I was coming. I was coming with the freebies, but it meant you had to rock my stuff, you know, if you wanted this.
Right.
And Carl Kanai, still, I mean, I keep Carl Kanai anytime. I keep his stuff here. I'm like, I'll rock it. I will rock his stuff, so I will make everybody fall in love with it again. If they see me in one of his old, the 90s pieces, they're like, oh, my God, where'd you get that from? Oh, don't worry. Let me know if you're doing something hot. We can get it placed on you, too.
Man, you know, and one thing about it, too, Kenya, that a lot of people really got to understand, man, because, I mean, we're just getting, you're just taking us back on all of this. Because, I mean, especially in the 90s era, because there was such a proliferation of, you know, black-owned brands, especially, of course, two black guys from Toronto, you know, African-American Clothing Alliance. A lot of people don't even know what Cross Colors and Carl Kanata, they had actually started under the same umbrella, Trends for Life, until they pretty much separated. I know that history. So it's like, I mean, but what was, you know, but the 90s represented, because when we look at that style today from the East Coast, especially because from the price point, I mean, Boss Jeans, Exhaust, Damage, Guess, you know, I mean, this was really, you know, I mean, we haven't even gotten into the starter parkas. One thing, and especially, you know, when you talk about iconic wear, because I would think about Tupac back in the day when he would wear a lot of the UNLV Running Rebel stuff, you know, which was emblematic of his, you know, revolutionary personality. And, you know, and when you look at Brenda's Got a Baby, he was rocking the UNLV parka, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, of course, NWA with the Raiders, you know, you know, all things California. I mean, the Dodger hat, you know, it's like, you all on the West Coast. Go ahead, please.
And NWA, believe it or not, it was this place, and this place is still my go-to place. Eric and all them would get dressed at this place. It's in Southgate called Greenspan. And the Greenspan is still owned by the same family for the last 52, 3 years. And
oh, wow.
They used to go there before any of the concerts. They would go there and dress in there, because they had all the gangster wear in there, right? So that was my place. When I worked on Straight Outta Compton, the executive producer brought me on because he wanted me to, you know, give that whole you know, this Death Row thing. He knew I was from that era, so he wanted the guys to kind of, you know, look kind of like that. And I went back to where Easy and all those guys began. And I spent 3 months at Greenspan going through their basement, all this stuff. I mean, I'm finding boxes from the 80s of all kind of stuff. Pony, you remember Pony? Pony t-shirts, stuff
British
Knights,
all that.
Yeah. Everything was there. They still had all this stuff in the basement, and the owner and his son, oh, my God, I love them at Greenspan, let me go through everything. And I pulled most of all my key pieces that you wouldn't know between that and then Michael Jordan. They got me some vintage Nike, and then Carl Kanai. That's what pulled that whole Compton look together. It was all just finding little pieces. And it's always little pieces that you find to kind of create it. But then you got to have Carl Kanai. Carl's my right-hand man. You got to have him. And back to what you said earlier, Carl was going to play Tupac. And, Tupac was like, no, you a black man. I would never do that to you. Never. And that resonates with Carl to this day. And he's paid it forward to so many other people. So when Pac did that for him, you know, Carl pays it forward to someone else. So, it kind of works in the circle, you know. And I keep reminding these people, it's enough for everybody to eat, everybody. It's enough. You do better with sharing and keeping your circle tight and your same old people. It works. It's been working.
Definitely. Go ahead, King. Go ahead.
Yeah, especially when you're sitting there and you got to listen to the music and the style and how it resonates in the fashion. Just like I like how y'all did also the whole mafioso look that y'all came. Now, I noticed a change happened around then when Tupac got out there and he signed up there. Y'all went from khakis and hockey shirts to suits. Did you play a role in that, or did Tupac bring a role in that?
Tupac, you know what? Tupac came in, and I promise you guys, I was trying my hardest to get on. When him and Shig would go to Vegas, I'm like, I'm going, because I wanted to watch because he was so, oh, God, like from the first week he got out, he transcended. It was so, he grew up. And I think that a lot of people, a lot of the artists were watching him, because when he came, everything started changing. Everybody started to get that grown man, and you started seeing things that you hadn't seen on some of the artists, like, okay. And it wasn't at that point, Pac created a lot of stuff himself. I won't even say that they brought in another stylist. He was doing a lot of stuff himself, you know. But when the Versace came in, that's Kadada. She brought that in, and that's when things really transcended, when that Versace came in, and that was a direct connect from Quincy Jones and Kadada. You know, that's what everybody was like, oh, shit, we got to catch up now. We need to catch up with them because they on Versace. Okay, we ain't got there yet, but let's go. And I just wanted to watch. At that point, I became like a student because, you know, we hadn't got to Versace yet and all that. And
yeah, that's that big money. That's a big rap money.
Yeah. I was like, okay, all right, well, and then I start thinking for myself, shit, well, I got to start looking the part if I want to go over here. So I would have to take trips to New York to Century 21 to get Versace, all my stuff. I'm like, because I started seeing nobody in L.A. was really rocking the Versace. I would go to New York to go get mine because I needed to come back to L.A. to be a little bit different, you know, I'm watching how they're doing it, so I got to change a little bit. But I was a student at that point because Pop brought that noise.
Man, but, you know, when you look at it, though, Kenya, one thing about when we do shows like this, because we always get more than we expect and we absolutely love it when we do, there's always been an intrinsic link with fashion and hip-hop. I mean, for those, because, you know, we're older, we remember the old Dapper Dan days, you know, with the Gucci and the Louis, you know, and the Louis Vuitton on the New York side on the East Coast, you know. So, I mean, one thing about staying fresh and fly You know, and shout out to Dapper Dan, because he's like just one of the true legends of the game in terms of really pioneering that. You know, because he would get, for those that don't know, this is a quick education. What he would do is he would get the fabrics from these designers. He would buy the fabric, you know, and then what he would do is he would just, and he makes specialized clothes. Now, is me and King, is me and my brother always joke about it. We call this the old New York days. Like, this is where, like, the ball is. It's like the AZ. This is the paid in full. This is the guy, well, guy fishing.
That grimy New York.
This is where, like, all, like, the old New York gangsters was getting money. So it's like if you had a Dapper Dan or a tracksuit or, you know, like Rakim and they had on the paid, you was doing it. So,
Yeah, but Dapper Dan was it, and we were watching y'all. I mean, I'm watching the East Coast clothing wise because understand you guys are seasons ahead of us. So I gotta go to New York to forecast what y'all are wearing because y'all are seasons ahead of us. So I would bring that back a look. I went to New York very often. I was down there. I met a whole crew of girls that steal my girls now. I will go there, and they're like, all right. I say, you guys, this whole day, we're going to tear New York up. We got to go hit it high and low. We got to shop for everything. So that was my go-to place.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, so I mean, but when you look at it, you know, because back in the day when we look at how the music was always, because the culture is a street culture in itself. So we saw the evolution. We saw the different iterations of as it evolved because, you know, from the street fashion to where it was the – because if we break it down simply from – because we know how wild the 70s were, you know, with the disco era, you know, 78, Sugar Hill Gang, the first real big rap record. Then we get into the 80s. So we're getting into the tracksuits, you know, UTFO, we're getting LL, we're getting Run DMC. Of course, Run DMC really gets their product, you know, Adidas. Because one thing about it, I think a lot of people, and this is a conversation that has always been had about how hip-hop culture has really pushed the influence because – and it could be a bit long-winded, but I think I have to articulate this because I want our audience to get a full comprehension of the significance of something that a lot of people said was never going to last because hip-hop culture was born from the street. It was black and brown people having a way to express themselves but because we were marginalized. So as we start to make our music, people try to shut us out. But our message is not going to be denied. As we keep going, it becomes hip. When it becomes hip, it becomes fashionable. When it becomes fashionable, people really pay attention. When Run DMC does my Adidas starts taking off because Adidas is hip hop in terms of, you know, I mean when they shouted out my Adidas. And I mean, that was like it right there. And then, you know, and then that, you know, started taking off. I mean, the tracksuits, you know, I'm a diehard Nike guy. Nike wasn't there yet until Michael Jordan came in 84 when did his shoes. And Michael, you know, because sports and hip hop go together. Michael was, you know, when Michael. You know, it all goes together. And, I mean, so you're seeing, especially at a panoramic view, black people becoming a face for these brands. They're about, you know, because we epitomize the style. We elicit cool. We are a lot – we trailblaze on a lot of things that a lot of people may not – because part of hip-hop is being original, is being you. So we're going, and I'm not even getting into the 80s where we start getting into Public Enemy, you know, Chuck D with his trademark Raiders jacket, you know.
Yeah.
you know, Ice-T in 86 with Ryan Page, you know, where he's got the player suit on, you know, I mean, with a gold, I mean, and then we're not even getting to the gold chains yet. We're not even getting to the 90s with the Timberland boots and the hoodies and all that. I mean, God, I mean, how far can we keep going with all of this?
Yeah, it's, I mean, and dope, but then when you come back to the West Coast, I mean,
yeah. Okay,
we're picking up the starter jackets, right? And then we have a starter jacket. You have to understand that the gang culture was there. So you have the gang
right. Culture
picking up the sports. And everybody has different hoods, have their own starter jacket, their own hat. They start picking that up. So we're watching I'm just closing my eyes, and I remember the outfit I had on when I was in freaking, like, elementary school or whatever. I mean, I had the starter jacket on. I needed to wear my Levi's. They had to be creased. I had my shell toe Adidas on and then the fat laces. We were doing that. Like, we seen it, and we wanted to have it, but then we start giving it own twist. All right, so you're on the blue side, so you got to put the blue strings in. The people on our side have to put the red strings in. I mean, it just took
up.
I mean,
you know,
that was
flamed
the
up
culture.
And blew up. Yeah.
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 It
I
was
mean,
the culture.
Yeah. When you got.
Yeah. I mean, it was. But we had to be Elise. I wanted to. We had to be Elise. Y'all were doing the Fila, but okay. So I had to be Elise from head to toe. Okay. And then the Gucci boots came out probably like in 87. And then all the girls, we were all young girls, but we had to have the Gucci boots. That's what they were wearing. So now I want my bamboo earrings. I want my Turkish rope, and I want that in L.A. So we're watching your seasons and bringing them here. We're doing it, you know?
Yeah,
but we spin it a little bit and just add our little flavor.
Yeah, and that's one thing about it, man. I mean, we get into, like, even with some of the sets out there. I mean, you know, the 60s rock the Seattle Mariners. I think Athens Park rocks the Anaheim Angels because of the A. You know, of course, Broadway, you know, Broadway Gangsta Crip, you know, shout out BG Perico and all of them because they started, you know, he wears the, you know, you'll catch him wearing the B, you know, I mean, of course, any, if you have the blood set, you know, you're going to have like, well, you got just like with the Pyrus, they're going to be rocking the Philadelphia Phillies, just like with a lot of blood sets, they're going to be wearing the Boston Red Sox, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's all about, you know, Cedar Block, you know, Red Cincinnati hat. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's
know,
so much.
I mean,
and all these hats, when we go, let me tell you what the feedback we get on motion pictures, the baseball league, we can't clear not one hat for no movies, nothing. Because they've made so much off this is the L.A. gang culture. They made so much money, but they don't want us to rock their stuff on a film. We will get in so much trouble if we have a hat placed on anybody. They're very particular. They'll let it slide, but if it's a scene, if somebody's smoking a joint or if they're speaking profanity, you can't rock any of their hats. But the black culture have made you. I mean, the black culture has made a lot of these designers. I mean, UGG boots, all right? I put UGG boots before they were even popular, right? I got them placed on a show back in 2000. Nobody even cared about those big old boots. When their revenue start going up, then they start shutting us out, all right? All of them. Under Armour. Let's talk about Under Armour. I was one of the first people to get them placed on the UPN show back in, what was that? That was in 2001. Under Armour had just started freaking in a basement. They sent me like 15 pieces. I had it placed on there on a show, and revenue started going up. And some of those brands piss me off. Louboutin. Everybody watching Louboutin. Everybody's like, oh, I gotta have my Louboutin, my red bottoms. Let me give you red bottoms. 2000. Okay, in 2000, Tracee Ellis Ross was one of the first people really taking that brand.
Girlfriend.
When we were doing Girlfriend.
Right.
No one cared. Those shoes were freaking, what, $200? And then they gave us a 30% discount off the shoes? But then now, look at them now. Yeah. So this is the brand. I've watched these brands. I've watched how they showed me love when it was just two people working for them. Now they're corporations. bigger corporations. You know, I gave them their first plug on a TV thing. Under Armour, I'm hands down one of the first people that got them on TV on UPN. And Reggie Hayes from Girlfriends rocked it, and someone else. So, you know, I'm all in the branding, but you don't – one thing I don't like, don't shut me out when you make your billions of dollars, because you got to remember who got you on TV in the first place. And that's what I love about Michael Jordan
right.
brand. They won't shut me out. They show me love. I don't care what state I'm in. I don't care, you know, if I need Bobby Brown and them, I needed Jordan in 24 hours. Man, somebody went and got that thing on a plane from Seattle and got that hit next day. So
those are
that's
those, I think, the
right
Fire
there.
Red Five. Those are the blue, the suede. I think he had on those suede
yeah,
fives,
yeah,
the Toros.
Yeah, they
were. Yeah, the
yeah, they were
five.
Pulling.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were pulling stuff because it was last minute, and whatever was in that room, they got it. I was trying to get, you know, I was trying to get them the Travis Scotts before they even came out, but they're like, no, we can't pull them right now. I'm like, please let me. I said, do you know if I got Bobby rocked the Travis Scotts before the world? He said, I know, we can. I'm like, please. I begged for those Travis Scotts because I wanted Bobby, the bad boy, to introduce them to the world, you know? And then
right.
Kevin Hart, when I work with him, I was talking to Kevin Hart's people, and he's like, hey, we got to get Kevin, you know, he got to get on that VIP list, the VIP list at Jordan. I'm like, oh, that's kind of hard because everybody can't be on that list. I mean, right now it's all about Travis Scott, Drake, Travis Scott,
right.
DJ Khaled.
Right.
That's the list right there. That's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the grand list. So,
you know,
yeah, I'm –
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Yes, I was saying, yeah, but it's wild, though, because, I mean, when I think about it, because shameless plug, and I sent you some stuff, too. You can check your phone.
Yeah.
I've been a Nike guy for a lot of years, for
yeah.
over the past 25 years. I remember in 1997 when they started running the ads in the magazine. Shout out to XXL Magazine, because they were one of the first ones to do it.
The old XXL.
And I saw... Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I saw. I'll send you that one too, that picture too. And I mean, you know, where they had the trunners. I mean, this is because I used to work in a shoe store, so I'm remembering when we're getting like the word in terms of the Jordan branding. Like, this is when it's nascent. You know, they're still developing it. It was Morehouse, North Carolina A&T, and Cincinnati that were the and Cal. Those were like the first schools back. Not Morehouse. It was Cal, North Carolina A&T, and mm-hmm. Cincinnati. Those were the first three schools because they were
right.
doing the test run. And I mean, of course, I remember when the Jumpmans came out, the original, the first Jumpmans, the white and navy blue. You know, Kevin Garnett wore those back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when Ray Allen, you know, when he came out of UConn, you know, in addition to negotiating his own deal with help from Johnny Cochran, rest in peace,
mm-hmm.
you know, of course, I believe Michael had approached Ray Allen about, you know, yo, I'm starting up this on my, you know, my brand, you know, my company, and I'd like you to represent it. You know, I think Carrie
yeah.
Kittles, I want to say, was part of it as well, possibly. So, I mean, this is, I mean, so Michael, for what he was doing, because he had already conquered it, and the only next step, logical step in that aspect of time, because we really got to look back to where Nike started their dominance. Jordan was the face of it, basically be, you know, heading up the bat. Now Jordan is basically going and starting his own and
yeah.
just takes it off from there. I mean, and when you, and I said all that to say, because when you look at the impact Michael had just from the level of athletics and popularity,
mm-hmm.
those shoes have transcended now into a level of a stratosphere of just
billions.
An undescribable, yes, I mean, just an undescribable aesthetic of the elite. I mean, when you start seeing, you know, mainstream celebrities like Jason Sudeikis, you know, or whomever, I mean, you know, you're seeing them wear it. You know, I mean, you're talking about,
yeah.
we're not even getting to the Dorum Beckers You know, shout out to Dawn Becker Children's Hospital, which those shoes, all those profits from those sales go directly to the hospital. The Travis Scott, because what you said, going back, Kenya, to what you said, I can understand why they didn't probably want to do the Travis Scott, because those were specific, those were signatures for him. So they wanted to kind of keep it. They wanted to have that rollout specifically for him. We're not even getting to the Carhartt collaborations with Eminem. We're not even getting into the Cole collaborations that they had. Yes, I know.
The OVO is my favorite. I like that, the OVO, when he collaborated with him.
Yes.
That was it. When Drake came in, that was like it right there.
I was like, whoa. And I had to, Nike just choked it out on everybody.
and let me tell you where my plane is going, you guys, so you can see where my mind is going. So being that I played a role in the growth of some of these companies, right, you know, just, you know, getting them here. And then you guys see me with my launch pad right now, you know, producer's chair now. I've been in the producer's chair for a while, but y'all have to understand it takes a little while for a woman to really, you know, in the West Coast, all that, to really move about.
Right.
You know, I was one of the first black girls that got a deal, a license deal at Starz back in 2003, but, you know, everybody had foreshadowed the woman. You know, people they might know that, but I went and got my own deal there when they weren't even doing it. I did the first Dog Pound Snoop Dogg documentary through my company and got the first licensing deal for 2 years under me, my company, by myself. And, you know, Daz got down with me. You know, Daz is my ex, but he's still a good business partner, you know, when I need to call him. Big U's with me now. That's been family since I was a kid. He was a kid, but
shout
I'm taking it
legend.
Now.
Yes.
Yeah, Big U, that's my right hand right there. Like we got a lot of good deals going on because, you know, we see it. And a lot of things are in our hand, and we're not afraid to share it. Like, I'm like, okay, bro, what do you think about this? So, he trusts my judgment. I trust his. But my thing is with this, you guys see me working on the Raymond Washington project. When I close my eyes, I see it bigger than most people can imagine. They put it on a lower scale, but my thing is branding and showing the world something different. You know, of course, not glamorizing anything, but showing a culture of how this began and transcending it. And then, you know, getting brands involved. You know, I just see so many big things because I want to put all the things that I have learned all these years into, okay, my first real, you know, series production that I know it's gonna go to another level, you know. And I just imagine,
right.
I mean, God, I was on the phone with Charles Oakley telling him about the Chris story. Charles was like, huh, Kenya? I'm like, Charles Oakley, you don't know Raymond Washington? He's like, no. I said, well, let me educate you. So it's, all the stuff that we talk about, I'm going to take that all in and bring it, this launch pad is something that I'm doing and involve everybody that I've ever worked with. I'm like, I need the team, the people who got down with me. I mean, Carl, I might need him to do a specialty shirt, something designed that something what Raymond had on, he wore back in the days, but it's something custom that Carl can come out with now, you know? Or, Nike Cortez came later, but maybe a company could create something that he wore, you know? A shoe that he wore, like that we can bring it back. I'm just trying to cross connect everybody and give everybody like a seat at the table, you know, and, you know, get, because branding is so important. It's so important to me, you know, and Raymond's story, that's like my baby right now, you guys. I just can't. I have to throw that in. I took like 20 steps
because I had to get him out. Kenya, we are glad that you threw that in because, you know, we talked about this before the show because this is something because one thing about it is we like to this is something that we love to pace it and we love to let it organically flow. You mentioning it because now we can go full throttle into this because, you know, you and me had the pre-interview conversation and we chopped it up heavy on that. King and myself, you know, we had that conversation, so we're going to go ahead and get full on into it now. One thing about it is California is pretty much known. Obviously, the Bloods and Crips story you know, is the most prevalent one. We saw Oliver Stone with Colors. We've seen Baron Davis with, you know, Bloods and Crips Made in America. So what makes your documentary, upcoming documentary, so spectacular, Kenya, is because you are, because there's so many questions we have to ask you in terms of your opinions, and we're just going to kind of, you know, lean into it here. But the thing is that there has never been a documentary from the scale, because like you said, you have a different vision for it, because basically you are going from a panoramic view of basically directly telling the whole Crip story in a way that has never been told. I mean, shout out to, you know, Raymond, you know, shout out to Stanley, you know, shout out to Barefoot Pookie. I mean, we talking about, you know, we talking about, look, we talking about 60s, 8 Trays, you know, 5 Deuce, you know, we talking about.
Shout out to Kev Mack and all them, because they have been, I've been in everybody's archives, Barefoot Pookie, Cute. All their archives, digging in their stuff. Pookie knows. I mean, that's the, every day in the morning time, I get two calls in the morning. Two calls early in the morning. The two calls I get is Raymond's mother and Pookie. That's my daily calls for the last year. We have these conversations because we need to keep it going every day. Every day it's a dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, we have to look at essentially because, you know, this is off-the-cuff radio, and we always going to keep it real in terms of speaking the facts on it, you know, even when we dive into certain things. One thing about it is, of course, people have to understand the etymology in terms of the language. We have to understand exactly where it started in terms of the acronym, initially meaning community in a party, revolutionary service, or community revolution in action. I mean, there's so many different elements of it. But then we, you know, we look, because basically the Crips were birthed from that same level of, you know, the Black Panthers in terms of the spirit of it. We're not even getting into the history of the city of Compton in terms of how it was, you know, predominantly white at one point. A lot of people don't know this until 1948 until 1948. When the federal government passed the Anti-Discrimination Housing Act, which basically ended housing discrimination. So you had Black people moving into Compton and the white people were moving out, the white flight. Mm-hmm. But then we also get into it, too, where we actually have some of the white gangs that were terrorizing the Black gangs, like the Spook Hunters and a lot of other white terrorist gangs that were in. This is where you started seeing a lot of these Blacks, you know, the Black people forming these coalitions to protect themselves. And the Crips became one of the most notable, you know, with Raymond and Raymond and Tookie, you know, bringing it together.
Mm-hmm. You know, and before it was Raymond and Tookie, people always forget Craig Craddock. And that was the first person. Craig was killed, unfortunately, when he was 19. But that was the first person that Raymond confided in. That was the one when he came up with that name. It was those two sitting in the room. You know, they were sitting in there having that conversation. And then, of course, he gets he's killed off at 19. So then you have the Tookie to come in. You have the Melvin Hardys to come in, the Michael Concepcions to come in, the Lonnie Keelans, the Michael Christians. You have all them coming in, you know, when he's forming this. But initially, this is a Raymond and this is a Craig Craddock conversation at first, and then it trails on to everybody else. That's where that's where it began. When they were young, they were kids, they're 14 years old, you know, so that conversation happened. That was prior to everybody else going in. I mean, you know, you go into 1970 in his recruitments, he's meeting everybody, you know, he's meeting all these people in 70, you know, recruiting everybody. So that's when your Tookies come in. That's when your Crip Crazy, your Mac Thomases, your Little James Comptons, your Mad Dogs, your Motos are coming in. They're coming in when he's in the 70s, 72, 70, 72. Mm. So, you know, people, you know, they have a misconception. I mean, I've talked to Crips in Africa, in Iran, all around the world, and, you know, they have this thing on, you know, Tookie started the Crips, and I have to, you know, I don't reprogram them at this point because I'll let the story tell itself, you know. But, I mean, Raymond was gone in 79, so of course, Tiki, you know, he was the popular face at that point, but we have to get this out there, you know, and I promise, you know, Raymond's mom, you know, we're gonna tell an elegant story. We're not going to glorify anything. We want to tell the truth about where it manifests from, and maybe we can save some lives. You know, maybe it'll save a life or two. But if we get it right and tell about the community and why it was started and what was going on in the brain of a 14-year-old, what he felt that he had to carry this on his shoulders, we got to get deep into that. You know, I mean, that's a lot for a 14-year-old to carry on his shoulders. I mean, where's your mind at this point? Something is missing. All the people around you are dying, all the people you look up to. So now you at 14 want to be the hero because everybody else that you've looked up to has gotten assassinated. So we got to peel all that apart, you know, and it's going, you know, for me, I tell people, I said, it's more than 90 minutes for me. I mean, Raymond is more than 90 minutes. I mean, Raymond is 4 or 5 seasons to really peel apart, to really get deep into the single family, the single mom that raised Raymond and, you know, his brothers, his 5 boys. You got to dig deep into why, what was it like in that household? You know, what, you know, Raymond was the only one out of all the brothers that, you know, were really involved in the gang culture. Everybody else was lived as kind of like a straight line. So, yeah, it's a lot to tell, and I'm grateful, you guys, to have his mother, who takes business calls with me. She's turning 91 years old on Friday, and she takes meetings with me over the phone. I'm grateful for Ray. I'm going to tell you who I'm grateful for, and then we're going to go back to that. His daughter, Ray Ray, little Raymond, his nephew, Ron.
Shout out,
I'm grateful for them, Barefoot Pookie, Big U, all these people, my partner, Jerron, all of them that are on the forefront, you know, supporting this, Kev Mac, you know, S-Mac, all of us, you know, it's a group effort, you know, with the documentary. And then, of course, when we get to the series, the television series or film or and film, then it's going to grow into something even bigger. Because who's to say that, shit, you know, Michael Mann or one of these big freaking directors won't come and want to get down. I mean, of course, I want to get an African-American director. I really want one. You know, it's just that sometimes, you know, people don't see your vision, you know, at the beginning. You know, Benny Boom, shout out to Benny Boom. He's down with us. He's the first one that stepped up to say, hey, I'm down with you. You know, we haven't, you know, I respect him. But back to Raymond's mom. Yeah, when I take product meetings, you know, because we're trying to get networks to pick up the series. Raymond's mom joins me on the calls. She's very keen. She gets on there and tells, you know, who she is, her age, and she sits there, listens to what's going on, asks questions. And the people find it so remarkable because everything, she is sharp as a tack. You know, she knows everything. It's like 91 years. I mean, you would think the woman is maybe in her 50s. I mean, just very on point, but hands-on. And I like that. I like for the networks and people to talk to us to see that this mother's hands-on. This is her baby that she birthed. She birthed the founder of the Crips. So it's very important for them to hear her voice, that, you know, just to hear anything in her voice that, you know, it might pick up, you know, that this is transparency, you guys. We need this to go. We need this story to be told. We really do.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, when you look at a lot of, you know, and one thing about it is everybody just looks at it from one part of it, but the documentary, you know, but the history, you know, is all blue, you know, in terms of, you know, so many. I mean, on the roster, I mean, you got Melvin Hardy, I mean, Benny, you got Batman, you got Jamel, you got Raymond Cook, you know, Christensen, you know, I mean.
Donald Archie,
you know,
all them others. Yeah. All these people. It's so many. And you guys, if you guys came to my house, my living room looks like, it looks like 1969. I have boards all around where I have done this research on every aspect from the day Raymond was born and everybody he's affiliated with, every street he's crossed. I wanted everything to be put on a vision board. So when you go into these pitch meetings, you know, when you go into these meetings, you got 20 minutes to sell. And I have every character that's kind of stepped foot in his life, anybody, they have a board. I mean, Pookie has a board. Craig Munson has Craig Munson has a board. Batman has a board. You know, all of them have boards because I need to dig into who they were and how they connected with Raymond. So it's kind of like a piece by piece on how this all began. Because when you go into these pitch meetings, you're dealing with people who are maybe in their third, they're white, white culture, and white,
right.
They're white, and they're probably in their 30 to 35 years old. And they weren't even born when the Crips, you know, came about. So we basically have to go in there and teach them all about, you know, this culture, why it's important, and why they need to buy
it. An educational perspective, that has been very violent at times, you know, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't have a heart, you know what I mean? And that's the most important thing, because when you're dealing, one thing about it with presentations is that, when you're looking at a lot of these documentaries that are so well made, I mean, these are situations where you're dealing with people who actually are understanding the real emotions, the people. Because the thing is, people look at it from just the surface, but you don't understand these are individuals that were born, and you have to look at where the formation was, where it began to, where it was fertilized, and then what the offshoots were from it. And these are people that just, you know, when the inner city situations happen, people fall into stuff, and it is what it is, but it doesn't make them any less important, because I believe everybody who is vital, their culture is something that has a story, because it's influenced so many rappers behind it. I mean, when we talk about Crip rappers, and we can say this because a lot of them, we haven't even talked about Sugar Bear, who invented the Crip Walk. I mean, we haven't even gotten to that yet.
When you think of that culture, then you have to break it down. Okay, there's the fashion part. There's the whistling. The Crip Walk and the dancing, the girls, everything. But it started, you know, for the L.A. culture, it all started there, and it continues on now. It keeps on going, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, the
significant,
whistle.
Right. Even the significance of the flag being to – even with the significance of the, with the flag to the left, you know, no Crip left behind, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's a lot, you know, just like, you know, where the Bloods, you know, have their flag to the right. You know, Bloods should be right by your side. Blue, no Crip left behind. I mean, there's so many layers to this. And one thing I wanted to ask you this, because you are you're an authority on this. You stayed in L.A. You were really out there with these people in terms of when it was at its height. We look at it with NWA, because if we break it down, because for all the shit NWA said on the records, and they said a lot, they never really threw out their sets like that. If you were from there, because we got to give our listeners another history lesson, because you got to remember, gangbanging culture, as we knew it on the East Coast, we didn't know really anything about it until everybody would say NWA. I'm like, no. I'm like, NWA opened up the door.
DJ Quick. It was DJ Quick. It was Ice. Okay, listen to Ice-T, but Ice-T was just, I don't know if we knew he was from Crenshaw, but when he's Crenshaw on that side, but then when you have Quick coming out, he's talking about I'm on a Rambi at North. He's telling you every block he's on in his hood, how he hangs and banging on that hood. I'm like, Ice-T was given, we knew he was from the blue side, but we didn't know.
Fadu.
I don't know if we knew. What did you say?
I think it was from Fadu. I could be mistaken, but
yeah,
I think it was Fadu Tuba. Yeah, right.
Yeah, but he didn't. It was not okay to let that be known at that point. It was still
right.
Kind of like,
my whole
you understand?
Point.
It was scaring people off.
Yeah, I can't let them know that I am from, you know, I wear blue, so you know, but I'm not calling out my block right now. But I just remember vaguely, but then Snoop came along, but then Quick was there before that. He's calling out, I mean, he's banging. I mean, tell me if there's somebody different, but he's calling banging.
Well, if you look at Subliminals, though, think about Compton's Most Wanted in 1989, straight checking them.
Yeah.
Well, I think not.
Yeah.
Compton,
oh, yeah.
Not straight checking them, the blue cassette. If you knew,
yeah,
then you knew
the blue tape.
The blue cassette, Trag knew. Blue
yeah.
Trag knew all blue. MCA, you know, boom, bam, Chilly Chill. I mean,
love,
yeah.
I was talking to the Chill the other day. The Chill is getting down with us on the music side and eight. I was talking to them a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
We have this Raymond conversation all the time. So shout out to them. Shout out to
yeah.
them.
Yeah, I wanted to.
Yeah, you guys. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on that about the movie. Is it going to have like a soundtrack? And if it does, who's going to be on there?
Okay.
Ooh, yeah.
Okay. So what we're doing. So listen. So the documentary first. Okay. So that thing is going to be editing. It's getting edited down in a couple weeks, and we have a certain amount of slots. You know, when you deal with documentaries, the scoring goes on, and how it works. During the documentary, you have different songs playing in different scenes of bringing in, like when Pookie's interview comes up or something comes up, we have something playing in the background. So what I did,
right.
I wanted to get some new artists involved because I have this thing about, I like new people to get a chance. You know, people don't always give the newbies the chance or someone that's been grinding for a long time. So I just kind of put
right.
out on the birth page, hey, I want to get some new artists. I want you guys to send me your
music. Z Perico. Z Perico.
I asked you, and people have been sending some amazing music. I mean, some guys that are, oh, my God, so talented. I haven't gotten
right.
girls, you know, on it, but the men have sent some music. So we're going to just go through, when we go through the editing process, we're going to see what songs fit where. So that's for the documentary. The soundtrack for the series, you know, that's going to be on a whole different level because once the network gets involved, of course, I always make sure when I'm doing my contracts that I control my merchandise and my music. I don't play that. You know, I learned that from
right.
previous deals. And music is important to me. I will not let anybody, you know, control the music from anything outside of our circle because we are music.
Right.
I mean, we are the music. We got so many talents around us, new and old, you know, and it's in my thing was when I close my eyes, I see some of the artists back in the day coming together with some of the newer artists, you know, and then also I'm reaching out to like eight and all the old, you know, the guys that have been doing this music game. I want to create something like,
right.
like a self-destruction, something like that to bring, I want some of the newer, younger Crips that rap to be a part of it, and then you have some of the older Crips that have been doing this and kind of bring those two cultures together, you know, and then bring,
yeah.
because it, we got to heal. I mean, we
yeah.
have to heal. We have to heal. I mean, I was just thinking, that, look at the guy, what's his name, Ron, is his name Rondo Bondo? Is that, am I pronouncing it right?
Quato
Rondo. He's a,
Rondo,
the little young boy from Chicago. Rondo Bondo?
Quato Rondo, and then you had Quando King
Rondo that got killed.
He's a Crip. He's a young little guy, and his music is good, and he's a Crip, and I see people like that because he's young. So, you know, you get a young artist like that, and then you bring in one of the older, you know, another Crip that's been doing music, a Corrupt, a Aid. You know, Sonny T, or, you know, somebody like that, you know, a King T, somebody, you know, MCA, one of them, and, you know, they bounce off of each other. I mean, it's something, I want Raymond's, you know, I want his soundtrack once we get there because we're not even there. You know, we have to wait, you know, to cross our T's and dot our I's, you know, with the network because you'll be jumping the gun saying what you're going to do. You're going to have to be in a partnership with like a major
right.
network, so you guys are going to have to come together, you know, come together. But I still stand on my music. I want it. I want that to be. It has to coexist with that. The music has to go along with that because this Raymond Washington came before all of this. I mean, when you see the Snowfalls and you see the Boys in the Hood and all that, we're telling
right.
the story before they even came. We're telling the story of how they came to be. Because if it wasn't for Raymond and all this, then they wouldn't be here. They wouldn't be able to tell the story. It wouldn't be a Crip side. So we're setting the standard. So it has to be done. It has to be done just, you know, eloquently. It has to be done with love and touch and the family involvement, you know, and you know, the right directors involved and just the right people that come in there. Everything has to be, I mean, it's a sensitive subject. I take this thing wholeheartedly, and everybody is not going to be invited to the table. It has to be done right. And I say, well, what if, like, you get a big director, like Michael Mann or, you know, like one of those big ones. What if they came and said, oh, I want to do it, you know, like a white director? I don't know how I would feel about that, because to me it has to be told from someone who has shared the pain that we've shared. And I think all of us have shared some sort of pain, you know, with being black. And that comes with, that comes with something. The police, you know, the racism and all that, we feel the pain. So I just feel like it needs to be someone who has felt that like we felt it. I mean,
it's got to be an L.A. thing. It's got to be an L.A. story, because I've always said, because when you're dealing with something from that level, there has to be an intimate understanding, because that's when the material is infused with life, because you can't artificially inseminate something if you haven't been there. You have to understand the nuances, the feeling, culture, conflict, compassion. It's an all-encompassing element of telling a true story.
Hey, T-Mac.
I was gonna
add this on to it, and this is where the music plays a key, because, you know, this is why this is a special show to me, because you are around the people that made huge contributions into this rap game and in the music world as a whole. Now, what you learn under being with Death Row, you learn a lot about sequencing, because sequencing plays a key role in delivering timeless music.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. And, you know, I've handpicked some of the people who were in charge of, like, artist development, like at Death Row, like a guy named Roy Tesfaye. Like, he's getting down with me on there. He was the one that basically held everything together. You know, he went to high school with me, but he held all the music together. He held all the tours together. He had all the bookings together. He had everything. You know, he knows the ear. He knows, you know, he was the one of the ones that discovered Lil Bow Wow. So, people like that, I trust, because they've been behind success stories. And, of course, everything that I've sat and watched with Death Row, I mean, you got to take the good, the bad, and the ugly, because it was not all ugly. It was, I mean, we were part of this dynasty of music. I mean, nobody can touch Death Row.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you cannot take that away. Death Row, we set it up. I remember we were one of the first, correct me if I'm wrong, but the whole roster, we were and took over one plane. I remember when Snoop performed at the MTV Awards, he performed "The Murder Was a Case." We had the whole plane. Yeah, the whole plane, all of us. We had the whole I think we had a whole floor at the Michelangelo Hotel in New York, and we did it our way. I mean, shit got wacky, but it was fucking amazing. I wouldn't change that for the world. Oh my God!
Well,
no, the things that we've been around and seen, and you know, the East Coast, it wasn't always bad. I mean, we used to go down to New York and hang out with Naughty by Nature. They would pick us up from the airport. They were good friends. I mean, everybody was all good. I mean, it just got wonky at the end, but we had love for the East Coast. I mean, was at one point. It was love.
You know, one thing about it, Kinga, because you were part of that era, so me and King have to thank you for your contributions to that as well, because I remember when The Chronic first hit, because when we first, because we were all young back in the day, so it's like, you know, I was 14 when The Chronic was released in 1992. So this is, I'm remembering when I first see the video for Nothing But a G Thing. So, I mean, this is when, and I'm still like, because this is a couple of years before I really get into my hip-hop education from a journalism perspective in terms of actually reading, like the Source magazines and all that. So I'm really not hip to the whole story of everything. You know, King was younger than myself back in the day, but King was already on it. So you're looking at a situation when we see, I'm not even really understanding like the whole thing of when Dre leaves. I knew Dre left N.W.A., but I didn't know all the story behind that. All I know is he dropped I watch Rap City one night, one afternoon, coming home from school, and I see this video, Dr. Dre, Nothing But a G thing, and it's new, and I'm like, okay, because I mean, you got to remember, this is coming a couple months after the 187, aka Deep Cover, that him and Snoop did for the Deep Cover movie.
Yeah.
So this is already done, set it off right there. That's the bomb that's already set it off. So like everybody's like, yo, like how they gonna fight? Then we get another like then we're like, wait a minute, Dre's doing a solo record and he's got Snoop on it.
Yeah,
I had that source issue where he told the gun to his head on the source cover.
Yeah.
I was like, man, this thing is going to be crazy. This thing will be
man,
crazy.
And I'm like, dude, and we didn't even know about Rage, Corrupt, Dad. We didn't even know about the Dog Pound yet. So when we heard the Chronic, when it finally dropped, oh, my God.
But all those people were placed. You have to understand, that wasn't a planned situation. I mean, you're at the studio, and when you had that, and when you had the Village Recording Studio over there by off of Santa Monica, and you got a whole hungry people. You know, people were waiting, laying on the couch, sleeping up there for weeks, hoping to get 8 bars. They wanted to rap. Dre didn't. Things happened organically there. I mean, it was a Snoop and Dre thing. But then Dre starts strategically, the brilliant man he is, he's placing people. You know, them boys didn't know that they were going to be on this song and that song and this song and have a place in here and the same shit and this, that. They didn't know. They just happened to be there. You know, I remember because I met Snoop before Daz even moved down here. It was I remember Suge from the NWA's Bodyguard days and Dre from over there. So when they're starting their own label, you know, I get introduced to them by Tracy. And Tracy Jernigan, one of my good friends, the love of my love, that's my love bug right there. She was Easy's girl at the time. So let's just cross out Defro. Defro ain't even here yet. I'm over here with Tracy as my best friend, and Ruthless is going strong. And I'm over here. I meet them. So it's all about that now. Ruthless and I'm learning Easy, and we're staying at his apartment on weekends and WA and all this. And then I remember when the riffs start coming in. I remember, you know, when the Dre is going over here, Suge is coming up, and now he stepped up to the forefront. And I met Suge right when all this is. He's 187 is I think just about. I think it was recorded or something, and I meet all of them, and we all hang out, and Snoop gets introduced to the picture, and we're all hanging out. Corrupt is not here yet. Dad is not here yet. Rage is not here yet. No one's here yet. Is Snoop there? And then everybody starts being placed at this point. They're coming in. Everybody's dropping in at that point. You know, and Suge was so smart, and Dre too. DOC as well. You know. You know, Dick Griffey gave, I mean, he was giving them, I remember the first Death Row albums on Coinga. Yeah, and Dick Griffey stepped in and was giving them the game. You know, then you had David Kenner, you know, who came in, you know, with the, you know, with the whole mafioso style Italian lawyer shit, you know.
Shout out to David.
Yeah, David was.
Yeah.
Oh, David I haven't seen him in so long, he's, you know, but. Everything, it was brilliantly done. I mean, people can say whatever they want about Death Row. That was hands down the dynasty history. Nobody could ever emulate that label, you know. Sharitha, that's one of my best friends. I was talking to her before we had the interview. My dog from day one. I mean, when I first met her, she didn't like me. You know, she was managing, you know, she came up. I knew everybody, but she didn't know who I was. And she pulls up and the Benz, and I was like, damn, I want a Benz. I mean, we weren't even on that level, but I was like, who is this chick? And she didn't, you know, we became best friends later, but she was a boss. And that was my first picture of a woman fucking boss playing. She's in charge of the dudes, and they're listening to her. And I'm like, oh, hell no, I like that. I like that boss style. The guys are looking up to you, and you telling them what to do? Oh, yeah, that's me. Well, I used to watch her, you know, move. Just how she moved.
I mean,
it was great.
Now, this is funny right here.
Go ahead,
right here. Now, see, what I observed from Death Row, because I remember Tupac saying something real funny on one of his shows when he said, "Everybody in the road got cases, even the females." Now that let me believe that you had to be real tough to really get down with the get down over there. And this was actually a surprise revelation about you. And big shout out to my man, Art of Dialogue, for the dope interview that he did with you.
Yes,
and you was the one that was fussing with Easy on Rufus Radio, and I didn't even know that was you.
Hell yeah, I was getting down with him. And you know what? I'm on, you guys, a shout out to the new documentary that's coming out, because I'm on a new documentary, the new Eazy-E documentary coming out, and we actually break down that whole freaking thing that the exchange that me and Eazy had. And it was over, you know, it was over Tracy. It was over, you know, it was personal to me because, you know, at that point, we know these dudes. They're rappers, they're young, they got multiple women, but if you're my homegirl, I'm getting in your ass. You're not going to be playing on my homegirl. You know, I'm going to ride with her. And that day, Daz and them got on there. They were arguing with him, you know, following behind the whole everything that was going on. You know, whatever. If Dre's mad at y'all, we mad at y'all too. So it was
right.
My time to go and ride on him for Tracy. Like, okay, well, they riding on you. Nigga, I'm riding on you for my homegirl. Fuck you. What now? And we were getting them in every direction. This nigga's like, Eric's like, well, damn, I'm arguing with them too, and then she pops in arguing about my relationship. Well, goddamn. We were all in this. We were all at the studio that day, and, man, Michelle was there, DOC, we were all there. We were just taking turns. Why we called up to Ruthless Radio, I don't know. You know, we wanted the problem. You know,
y'all wanted smoke before smoke became a thing.
We wanted that smoke bad, you know, because we knew that nobody wasn't going to do anything to us. And I'm going to tell y'all something. I don't think I've ever said this on an interview. All right, so you guys remember Jack the Rapper back in the day, like in the freaking 90s, like the, what was that? That was like 90. The last one was like in 1991, right? Jack the Rapper?
This isn't going to be about a fight that happened, was it?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, this is a fight.
I'm down there with them, okay? I'm down there with them, and I'm walking in, me and Little Malik, shout out to Little Malik, and all, and we walk
from Illegal,
in.
From Illegal, yeah.
Yeah, we walk in. And behind us is an all sea of red, and I'm, you know, all the, you know, the all the Shook boys, and all I know is that they ran toward each other, and me and Malik hopped under the table, and we were looking under the table at the fight. I'm like, oh shit, I ain't coming up. Malik's like, I ain't coming up either. We were under the fucking table while they're fighting at Jack the Rapper. I'm like, oh shit, what am I getting into? And this is the beginning. And I'm like, how do I keep on being around these crazy dudes? Every time we go somewhere, you guys behave badly. Get to Atlanta, y'all behave badly. We go to this state, y'all behave badly. Everywhere we go, you behave badly. We were looking under the table, but it was like some kids. We kept poking out our eyes out, and all we see was, you know, the sea of red just beating up everybody. I'm like, okay, we're going to stay here until they walk. Malik and I was like, we are not coming out of here. Hell no. That was just dope. I mean, I just had the fondest memories of everywhere we went, there's a goddamn problem. Everywhere we went. Everywhere.
Hey, hold on. 1 second. I think we got a 213 call on the line. Let's see who this is.
213, L.A., what it do?
Hey, yo, what up with it, man? I'm just calling in to say it's an incredible interview. I'm calling to support Kenya Ware. That's a great woman right there, independent ladies doing great things. And I just called to show my support for her, give her flowers while she's here, and let you guys know this is a great interview. That's all I want to say.
We appreciate
you,
man. We appreciate you. What's your name, man? We appreciate you.
My name, this is G-Lou, homie.
G-Lou, big Lou. What's
up,
man, from the 213?
Hey. Hey, Kenya, what's up? I just called to support Kenya and tell her she's doing an incredible job with everything she's doing, and we just want to give her flowers while she's still here.
Definitely.
And just say we support her to the fullest.
Hell yeah.
That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Dude, we thank you. We thank you for listening, man. Thank you. We appreciate you listening.
Oh, man, no problem.
Thank you.
No problem, bro. You guys keep doing a great job. Peace.
Appreciate
Thanks,
you,
bro.
Look, tell everybody about us, man. Appreciate all right. you. Thank you. Yeah.
All right.
Thank
peace.
Bye-bye.
Peace. But, you know, one thing about it, though, Kenya, you know, and shout out G Lou. Thank you for the call, man. We appreciate y'all
out
there.
Shout out to G Lou, G Lou Show, and Queen
yeah.
Jean and Flossie and all the whole crew over there. And we love all y'all.
Yeah, man. Much love. You know, one thing about it is strictly from, because the thing is, and, you know, being the older, distinguished gentleman we are, because me and King, we have all types of crazy, funny conversations off the air about it, because you know, people got to remember, like, for our young bucks out there, you know, now everybody talks about how things went down, how things go down now. I'm like, dude,
right.
Y'all don't even understand how this was going down in 93, and this is before social media.
Right.
This is before social media.
Can you imagine?
Let me tell you,
if social media, oh, my God, do you know? Oh, it would have been, I was just telling somebody, because nobody, understand this, nobody knew nobody's business. Nobody knew who was relationship, I beg to differ. My shit got out there. I mean, when on everything, you know, me and Dad separated. I did not know how, what, when, where, but it showed it get out there. I'm like, dang, his stuff ain't out there, but I'm not even, I'm just the ex, and damn, my little relationship's you know, my little side niggas, all this stuff is out there. Like, God damn, for real? How'd that get out there? This ain't even... How I get out there? God damn it. Like, I mean, let me just tell y'all. We done had fights in a court, court building, over damn. New York radio station. I mean, and this is over, God damn it, over me, when we're not together, me dealing with somebody else, and it's always something. I'm like, damn. Damn, can I breathe? I'm not even the rapper. How the fuck is my business getting out there? Hey, how did I get out there? I mean, I said, damn, it's normally the man that, you know, you go out there and do your thing, but then when I go swerve, it's like, I'm like, dang, how y'all find out I'm in Miami this weekend? How the fuck you find out somebody who's at my house? What the fuck? We don't even have the internet. Damn.
Man. I mean, but you know, one thing about it.
I almost started the East Coast War myself in 98, and I wasn't even with Dad. It was almost a part two on everything.
Oh, Lord.
But nothing.
Oh, shit.
It was some bullshit. I'm going to tell it because I don't think it's ever been told. So, fuck it. All right, so, you know, me and Dad are done, and he's gone off. You know, they got women. They going on about their lives, right? And for me.
Yeah.
You know, my place of refuge, whenever I needed to, you know, lay my head down, I would go to New York. That was just my spot because I worked there, everything. So I started dating this one cat out of New York, right, who was probably, he had the number one song at that point. And, oh, boy, that did not sit well. Oh, shit. That was just, I'm like, okay, well, we have dates. We're going to have to kind of go to your town because we can't come here because, you know, I don't know who's going to be tripping, but I remember one time it was on the radio station, and he kind of got threatened, and I took it personal. I'm like, you can't be threatening my new boo. Don't play with me. Don't do it. But I just imagine that shit being out there. Oh, my God. Internet would have been – it would have been bad. See, y'all have never heard about it. That's a good thing. See? But if it was the internet, it would have been bad. It would have been bad.
Only on Off the Cuff Radio, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, do you get these type of hilarious exclusives. You know, but the wild thing about it, though, is because this is a perfect amalgam of comedy, academia, and seriousness all at the same time, because what we're talking about at the time is because we're still, like, at that time, I mean, because we're obviously, you know, there was a lot of stuff. It's already been spoken on ad nauseum, so the whole death row history on a lot of levels doesn't need to be told because we've heard those stories. But in terms of certain nuances
yeah.
of it, just in terms of the street element of it, because on one hand of it, I guess I'll start from this perspective.
did you all really understand that you were going to be, like, when the album, okay, because a lot of people don't know that Death Row started off as Future Shock Records in 91 before it actually was, before the name became Death Row. A lot of people don't know that. And the record was recorded around 91 to early 92. When you heard the album, Kenya, did you all know that not only would this be a classic album, but this would revolutionize the way hip-hop was sound from then on, from East and West Coast? Because that album was just monumental in terms of the influence that it would bring. Did you all know
never.
What was coming with that? And this
not even a little bit.
Snoop's album drops next year, the next year, 93. But Chronic, 92, Snoop, 93, bam. I mean,
nobody knew. No, nobody knew. Of course nobody never knew. I mean, because you're thinking of, okay, Cube's prior album and then N.W.A. No one could have even thought that the Chronic would set the precedence of, like, West Coast history. No. And then Snoop brought more heat. And then the Dog Pound? I mean, it just feels, when you sit back and think about it, like, we didn't realize all those moments. Nobody realized that. I mean, all the moments spent, all the things that just all those pictures taken, the moments spent, all that, it's gone down in history. It's really gone down in history. It was legendary. I mean, think about, we did everything as a family. Should kept us all together. You know, we wouldn't let too many outsiders in. I mean, well, the women, all that, we didn't let too many outsiders in. I mean, of course, the guys might have been skirting a lot, but they couldn't come in our circle. Should made that point. You could not coming in. You better stay out there and stay in the cold. Stay in the cold. You know, if this is us, this is all of us here. You know, this is us, and we didn't know that. We didn't know.
Yeah.
I tell you what, you know how I'm reminded? I hit my old address in, that first house that me and Dad bought up in Silver Lake Hills that we paid like almost $500,000 for, and that sucker's like almost $5 million now. Oh, that kicked my ass. I'm like, God damn it. Damn. I'm like, damn. Just a piece of property that had the loan, I mean, something, how did we, and I found that house, and Marcus Johnson, the ex-basketball player, shout out to his ex-wife, Jocelyn Johnson, she's the one, me and her found that house because I said, I want behind gates, I want security, I want 24-hour security, I want an iron gate, and I want to drive up to the driveway like it's the freaking, like, you know, just all the way, and I got everything I wanted. And when you think about that, you know, when people say, like, oh, Suge did this to the artist, that's the artist, let's be clear, the artist lived really good. Everybody had their own houses, and that house, you know, when we had homes, it was in our names. I went and got the house thing, and, you know, we put money up, and it was in Dad's and our name. It was, Suge didn't, you know, from my perspective, I mean, whatever, you know, they say that he robbed him for it. Nah, bro, you guys were all living good. Everybody was living good. I mean, people were living so good, it was fucking ridiculous. I mean, everybody.
And I mean,
I haven't seen those days like that since then. How about that?
You know, but one thing about it, when we look at that, we look back at that time because I got Source magazines, because like I told you when we talked off the air, I have every Source magazine since 1994. So this is a couple of years then in terms of it. So I got between Death Row articles and covers, I got that 96 issue with Suge and the Rolls Royces, the white and the red one on the cover. I got
the 95 issue.
Yeah, I got that 95 cover with, you know, with Juelz, you know, Daz, Corrupt, Nate Dogg, rest in peace on that cover where they do that Western style saloon
I had that on my wall for a long time. That one that put it was the Source magazine. I think it was Source magazine, and they were all dressing back in, it's like a 1940s look.
Yeah, I got that. And I mean, of course, Snoop in 96, where they were talking, you know, where he's just kind of reflecting on that whole situation when he was going, you know, that because this was a shoot he did in accordance with accompanying the MTV Video Music Awards, you know, with the lightning bolts in the back and he's looking up to the sky, you know, and I mean, you all really, really, really turned the hip hop world on its ear, and you know, you know, the West Coast had already kind of, you know, was already doing it. You all kicked it into overdrive because when we look at that, this is, I mean, just in the albums that came out in addition to y'all, I mean, we look at 93 with Cam Never Again. We look at 1992, Compton's Most Wanted, Music to Drive By. I mean,
Quick is the Name.
Quick is the Name. I think that was 90. No, what was the King? I think Safe and Sound was that 95, I believe.
That was 95.
So then South Central Cartel, A Good Friends of Ours, and Gats We Trust, 1994. Boss, Born Gangsters, 1993. Right. I mean, you all on the West Coast collectively orchestrated. I can't forget one of my favorite MCs of all time, King T, the Trifling album.
King T, oh my God, King T, yes.
I mean,
that was King
you know,
T was banging it back in 88 and 89. That dude was doing it back then. He opened the gates for half it. Toddy T, him, all those guys, Mixmaster Spade, all of them. I mean, God, these guys, Uncle Jam's Army, all of them, they opened up the door for this, for everybody to come in.
They
left Fourth Wave was crazy.
And
the underground scene was dope.
Yeah.
And you guys know who MC Ren's MC Ren was a part of NWA early days, right? This is before
DJ Train?
Not Train. And Train were best friends, you know that, but this is around the time with him and Train.
Right.
His first favorite rapper, can y'all guess who MC Ren's favorite rapper was? And this is in 88. Because I remember me and him had this conversation probably like at the concert in 88, who his favorite rapper was, and I was thrown back. It was Too Short.
King T?
He used to like that
Too
song.
Too Short, okay, the best.
Girl, Her Name is Done. He said he used to bump that in his Datsun B210. I'm like, damn. I said, really? You like, yeah, Too Short. He's dope. That was Ren's favorite artist.
We can't forget Ren when he did the Kiss My Black Ass EP with Final Frontier and Mayday on the Front Line in 93. I mean,
but take it back to them, and you know, when he was doing it, you know, the villain was doing that back in 88 and 89. I remember the concert in 89 at the Celebrity Theater, and them guys, we were kids going to that concert, but they tore it up. I was like, this is my first gangster rap concert, and it was, I was like, it ended with a fight, but it was dope. It always ends with a fight and a whole bunch of chairs. You can hear me gunfire. It was just a whole bunch of chairs and bottles, and we just had to hide under our seats. That was the thing, you know, hide under your seat.
Right.
Yeah, man. Yeah, right. It was a...
I'm thinking about that whole Boondocks episode where Riley's talking about, you know how every time he's going to show it up, I bring out somebody else's chair. I was like,
right.
Oh, my God. I mean, but you all on the West Coast, man. I mean, you know, shout out to Richie Rich, you know, because Richie Rich was telling us about those old, because Too Short from the Bay. And we got to give love to the Bay. We got to give a love to the 415, the 408, the 831707.
I'm talking about the whole Vallejo and all of them. Yeah, because all of them, let me tell you, they spent a lot of time at my house. The whole Vallejo crew from E-40 and all of them. And some of the guys, I still had numbers on some of the guys who had passed away, like all that whole crew, Richie Rich's crew, and then Drew Down and all of them, Rap and Forte. I still talk to Rap and Forte all the time, but dang, those guys, the Oakland guys over the Vallejo, they were always in the – we had a studio at the bottom of our house, and all the time, 40 Water and all of them will always be there. I mean, I can always see faces, and I think that those guys were down there more than anybody, you know, always there, always.
Yeah. You know,
all of them.
D-Shot, I mean, Sugar T, we interviewed her last year. I mean, but when we really started seeing, because Rap City was like, that was our street, like when I was in school back in the day, high school. We were home to watch it. So we got introduced to a lot of the Bay Area. I mean, I did, you know, in terms of, you know, of course.
It's the West Coast,
you know,
scene, rap period.
And yeah, right. I mean, Rapid Bay, you know, out of Frisco, you know, the Players Ball, I mean, Off Parole, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Mac Dre, Too Hard for the Radio.
Mac Dre. God, Mac Dre, yes.
Because
I would say this, too. Because I would say this, too.
Yeah.
Because y'all would say this, too. See, throughout the 90s when y'all was flourishing, that made us out-of-towners want to see y'all. Because in the 80s and the late 80s, we were scared of y'all. Real talk. When we saw what y'all had going on with NWA and Compton's Most Wanted, we were like, nah, man. West Coast is like the Vietnam of the United States. We ain't trying to come out there, son. But when Quick came out there, then Death Row came out there, y'all had more of them jams. We were like, yo, we want to be a part of that atmosphere.
Right.
Y'all brought a lot of fun factor into the game, too.
It was nonstop. Those years, you got to know that those years we lived. We didn't even know that you were living on the edge. You didn't even know, like you had no idea it was just a way of life. And then you look back on it now, and you're like, damn, we were living on the fucking edge. How do we survive that and that? Crazy. But I want to bring, but we got to bring the southern in there because you guys understand Daz was from the West Coast, but he spent a lot of time in Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? So Daz had met all them guys, the Mysticos, the MJG, 8-Ball, all of them. I remember going to see them.
Hello, we here?
Yeah, I think she got dropped. She's gonna. I hope she's gonna call back. Yeah.
Dude.
Can you call back a little?
Yeah, can you call back? Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you know how
blog
talk. Here she go right here.
Okay.
Yeah,
perfect,
sorry
perfect.
About that. Something happened. You got it glitched.
No, you good? Go ahead.
Yeah. So you think about the Mysticals. I remember Daz met those guys before they even got their hands in it. I mean, he was going down there touching with all – before it was popular to go down there to Houston. We were down there in the wards going down there to see all these different people. And it was Daz that kind of opened up the door. It was Daz that opened up the door for, like, the E-40s and them. He befriended them. They would come – they were with him. So I just – I think about it. I mean, that dude was young – but his hands were in a lot of places, I mean, music-wise, because he understood the Southern music. He understood the Bay Area music. Well, nobody wasn't really messing with him like that. He did. He did. He opened up the door for a lot of those guys to be a part of this circle. As I'm talking, I'm just remembering all these different faces and just going traveling to Houston, Texas to see these people, or traveling to here to go see them, or going to Tulsa, or going here to go see these people. It was a beautiful thing. I mean, those moments, hip hop history of Death Row days, it just opened up the doors.
One thing about it, while Dre is credited for a lot of the music, how much does Daz? We can't forget Daz's contributions and some of the stuff he's done.
At all.
How big was Daz instrumental? Because I mean, tell us about his contributions in terms of the production and all of that, in terms of what Death Row was doing at that time as well.
Daz did a lot and didn't get credited for, because when you have him and rest in peace Emmanuel Dean, Pochop, they were young kids coming from, they were out of Tulsa. And Dre didn't credit Daz for a lot of things. I mean, Daz was responsible for a lot of the music that Dre took credit for.
We've heard those stories a lot, but he did, yeah.
Yeah, he did. Daz was a talent, is a talent. And I just think they took his kindness with weakness, we're going to get these young kids in the studio, we're going to have them working, We're going to get them to do the snares and the drums and do all the loops and all that stuff, but we're not going to give them credit for it. Daz was responsible for a lot, a lot of the What's My Name, all the things at the beginning of the Snoop Dogg album, Daz had his hand on it, and he just did not get no credit, you know. So, you know, people got to give it to him. I mean, I see a lot of these producers getting credit, you know, and it kind of infuriates me because I'm like, Daz is better than this person. He came out before him. How is he getting this? How is he getting that? This dude done paved the way. How is he suddenly popular in all this? This dude done set the opened up the gate. So it's just, you know, I just think that, you know, Daz is a quiet guy. He didn't, you know, ask for all the, you know, the attributes behind it. He should have pushed, you know. It just wasn't him. You know, you see him more vocal these days. He's responsible for a lot of stuff. And believe me, if he told you he did it, 9 times out of 10, he did. You know, he just didn't get credit for it.
Because when we heard that revenge,
and people overlook his contribution.
Yeah,
I was saying people overlook that his contribution to All Eyes on Me. Like, even people were thinking Dre did that whole album, but I'm like, nah, son, Daz did that, man. It's the, some Daz of those loops and some of the way he put those beats together. Ambitious as a Rider and all that.
Yeah, I mean, like I tell people, when my mind made up, that was Daz's beat. He was using that for something else. Tupac just happened to like that, and he took some of the vocals off and switched it to his stuff. But Daz had created a lot of that, you know, Gangsta Party, you know, a lot of that. I mean, dude was a genius. He is a genius. You know, they just haven't given him his credit, and he deserves his credit. You know, because he's a great producer. He's a part of. And when you say Dr. Dre in those days, you got to say Daz too. Okay, you got to say Emmanuel Dean too. You know, you got to say them too. They were part of it. They were part of that movement. You know, they were.
And one thing about it, I think that whole Death Row era just really encapsulated the West Coast because, I mean, like King said, you know, California made us nervous. When we saw the videos, I mean, all the videos, the lowriders, girls, we were like, we want to come to L.A. I don't know.
The weather, the women, and the weeds.
Yeah.
And when you came down here, we lived up to every one of your expectations, didn't we? We gave it to you. When you came down to L.A., you're going to get it all. We were going to serve it to you on a platter. What you want? You want some weed? Okay. You want some pretty girls? Okay. Here you go. You want some nice weather? Every day.
Look, just because even though I was born and raised Tampton Rose, two up, two down, Seaside, you know, Virginia, you know, Chesapeake where I reside, I mean, I got to shout out, you know, Ladera Heights, Baldwin Hill, you know, got to shout out, you know what I'm saying, you know, I mean, got to shout out Vallejo, East West Oakland,
yeah.
You know, I mean, especially, I mean, the women out there, I mean, y'all just, I mean, I especially got a thing for Bay chicks. Oh my God,
man, Cali women are melt our hearts for real.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's why we get lost in the sauce when we come out there.
Yeah.
hey, right now you just got to push through the plastic now because unfortunately back in the days what you seen was all everything was the hair, the nails, the body, all that was the OG, and you guys love that. You know, right now you got to push through the plastic and all the BS, you know, to get to the real deal. And I guess that's all around. That's everywhere. It's not just here.
That's
it's everywhere. You know, the natural.
Man, that's just society.
Yeah, like,
that's just society right there.
Yeah.
But,
I was just thinking, back in the days, everything. I remember, you know, you go to Cancun, everybody just was looking at everybody's hair, their nails, their face. Everything was so natural. I mean, God, and now it's like, okay, you got to see who got the biggest plastic booty and who done messed up their face. I have to look on there, and I'm like, who done messed up their face with plastic surgery? Because a lot of people have messed their face up. Somebody told them they get a different nose, and now they look weird. I'm like, come on, you were looking good all them days. Why you going to mess it up? Everybody wants the same Michael Jackson, Donatella nose. You don't need that.
Yeah, the rhinoplasty and all. Everybody wants that same rhinoplasty. And when I look at it, because I think that's why that era for us is so we rever it with such respect and fondness in our sentiment that is so sincere.
Yeah.
Because when you look at pictures of Aaliyah, rest in peace, Angel. I'm gonna throw another one out there for. And I'm going to throw another group out there for a lot of the heads that if you really know your R&B, especially on the West Coast, two groups. And I was in love with all of these girls. Oh, God, the things that would have went down with me and all of them. 7669 and YNV. Whoo, boy.
Wait, you said 7669?
7669. Their album, I believe, was on Motown, but it was 1993, called From a Bad Block. They had a song called So High and Joy. I remember when I first saw, I want to say they're from South Central. Of course, YNV, because I was big on a lot of West Coast girls back in the day. I mean, Smooth, of course. I mean, I saw her in that video for You've Been Played, and I just seen a bathing suit and some overalls, and I was like, oh, my God. I was 15 at the time. That was off the Menace to Society soundtrack, one of the banginest ass soundtracks. Oh, God. Shout out
Top
to
five.
EA, Ski, Spice One, you know, MCA.
Spice One, yes. Spice One, I remember that was the Freaknik days. You got to listen to, you got to have Spice One, have some Luke on, Too Short, go to Freaknik. That was
yes.
The music. That was it. That was the music.
You guys, you know they're trying to bring that back, right?
It's not.
It's never
going to
be the Freaknik of the
'90s.
Nah. It's never going
to
be like.
Can
the
you imagine
the
Freaknik now? It would get shot up, and it would be just, oh my God. And you know, it's not that the whole college scene. It was such a bond. I mean, we would go to the. No, to the Howard homecoming. You wear your Howard sweatshirts, and you go to the. You be in D.C. and you hit Atlanta. Half the kids aren't even in college anymore. I mean, it's not popular these days to be at a HBCU. Like it was important during them days to perform there, to go there, to be a part of that whole unity thing. And it doesn't seem like people make it that important. Like. Freaknik would just be a whole bunch of street dudes and street girls running around. It wouldn't be the college whole thing because they wouldn't mix. They're not going to mix at this point. That's two different crowds.
No.
And not to mention, everybody is so want to put themselves on camera. It's only a matter of time before somebody go live on the gram and a nigga catch his wife out or his mom or his girl or his mama out there doing some freaky stuff.
God. Oh, you guys, what if the gram was during the Freaknik time? Oh, my God. It would have been bad.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing about it is in certain adult video stores, you could find some of that footage that they would put it out. And I'm like, you know, me and my peoples will see that, and we're like, and you got to remember, y'all, I'm like, at the peak of Freaknik, I'm 14, 15 years old, so I wouldn't go to Atlanta for the first time until I was 16.
Right.
I remember my dad drove past. We were riding past Spelman. So for those that don't know out there, Spelman is an all-girls school. So I'm young.
Right.
We just riding past. We in a Lexus. I look outside, and I'm like seeing all these college girls. I'm about to tell Dad, let me out.
Right.
I'm like, leave me on that campus for about 5-6 hours. I'll be okay. Trust me. And I'm out of town too. Oh yeah, I will be all right. So
you gonna be
all right? I'll be more than all right. I might not. I'll be feeling Jack Tripp with more than three's company around me, man. But when you look at that era, though, it's just one of those things
era.
I tell people, like, you know, especially with the music, the bass music that was coming up from Miami, Clay D, Magic Mike, you know, Splat Pack, you know, all them, you know, it's like that whole era was just a total vibe, man. And, I mean, you know, I was too young to – you know, I couldn't get there, and you know, but I tell anyone, you know, who was there, you lived a golden era that we will never see again. Not at that level that Atlanta used to do it. I mean, God, the stories we heard about what it was like in Freaknet. I mean, whole Peachtree would be shut down. Peachtree Street is like shut down. I mean,
Peachtree, I-20, get out on the freeway, start jumping on the cars. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
The whole Piedmont Park was filled up. It was just freaking amazing.
And
it was
no violence.
No violence. It was nothing. I mean, everybody got along. We didn't have to worry about it. I mean, if you heard something about it was a random gunfire, it'd be like, for real? But, nah, it wasn't none there. Nah, it was nothing. That it was a beautiful thing. And then you had Jack the Rapper, all the music conventions that we used to go to, all the How Can I Be Down, everything. Meet up in Cancun weekend. They don't have this love that we had in the 90s. I don't know what they're doing now. I mean, I have no idea, but it was all about going to school, for being a part of the college crowd. You're young. It was just beautiful.
And especially
I don't think it'll ever come back.
And especially me going to an HBCU, shout out to Norfolk State, behold the green and gold. It's just a different vibe going to a HBCU and then really mingling, because nowadays, niggas, you come to a different spot. Niggas might ice grill you. You know, they don't know you. You were going there back in the day.
Oh, you can get a lot of play hate going on.
Yeah, but you go there back in the day, it's like, yo, what's going on? Well, I'm from here. I'm from there. Yo, it's good to meet you. You know, there was a real kinship.
Dang,
there was a brotherhood. There was a sisterhood.
Right.
They're not going to give you a tour.
Yeah,
where do you think it changed to a degree in terms of how did the culture, where do you think the culture shifted, Kenya?
Where the culture went, I mean, we have to say the music, of course the music went when Napster came in, of course that took all the music away, right? And I think the culture went bye-bye when the social media whole play came in, because it was kind of good to just be anonymous with things. Like, people did not know exactly what you were doing or exactly where you were. I mean, it's no type of exclusive. You can't be exclusive now. Everybody knows everything. Music-wise, I mean, you know, they drop it. They put it up on the Instagram. It's on. It's out there now. No one's buying the album. It's nothing exclusive now. It's nothing. You know, everything is right now, here now. It's the microwave. We're in a microwave era. And that's the music, too. I mean, because look at the level of shit that's out there. I have to shake my head when I'm figuring out who's getting a deal. I'm like, they're rich and they got a deal. Like, what? And this one guy, and I don't want to miss it. He's a rapper, and I guess people like him a lot. And he's not from L.A. or nothing. But he's the weirdest rapper. I'm trying to figure out why he's rich. Like, he sucks. And I'm like, God, like, it's come to that. Like, we had good music, and it was good content. You knew when you went to Atlanta, you go get the Dungeon and family, and you're going to get all that good music. And when you went to New York, and when you went to the Bay Area, you went to Texas, you went all up and down there, you knew you were going to get good music. Virginia, you knew that Teddy Riley's whole crew was up there. It was good music. Now, it's just, I don't know what the shit is. I'm trying to figure out how people keep getting deals, because I'm listening to the music, and I'm like, how did he get a deal? How?
I know, Method Man was talking. And, you know, Uncle Miff, you know, he was talking a couple months ago when he was like, how are these new artists getting all this money? He's like, I've been in this game almost 30
the
years. He's like, I can account
up.
For all my money come from. Yeah. He's like, where are they getting all this money?
Walking around with wads and wads and wads and wads of cash. And, you know, like, I think when I went to Atlanta, I was there for 8 years in Atlanta. And I remember when I got to Atlanta, the first, and I just went down there to visit, but I got the first movie I worked on was ATL. So this is new to me. I'm working on ATL. You got this kid, T.I., and all these people. And the only person I knew was Donna Ross's son, Evan, because Evan used to be on the set of Girlfriends, so I didn't really know, you know, all about the Atlanta culture, right? I didn't know. But yeah, I got down and I'm like, oh, my God, they go to strip clubs every night like a party.
And then all the guys, T.I. would leave set, and he would leave, like, accidentally like $15,000, $20,000 in his wardrobe, his clothes. And we would have to always call him. Tip, you just left, like, 2 wads of money. Oh, okay. Just save it for me for tomorrow. I'm like, what? You're not going back to get money? Like, they're walking around with wads. We didn't do that. Like, everybody had banks and accountants, and I don't know. Like, it changed crazy because we didn't live like that. Money, they had black cards, American Express cards. They had this.
Hey,
now,
yeah.
These guys just walk around with everything is in their pockets, but then their bank accounts are looking good too. Like, what the fuck do we mean? You know? But one thing that we did, you know, we were owning things. We were owning properties, you know, owning cars, owning prime properties, you know, albums, you know, they were going platinum plaques. I mean, you're going to get a platinum plaque. You're going to get 3 platinum plaques. These days, if they go gold, that's a good thing. They're celebrating. And I'm like, you're celebrating just going gold? That ain't shit. Because Dad's and Crepe and them used to go platinum on everything they touch. Like, why aren't you, I'm asking them, why aren't you going platinum? You're satisfied with gold? Like, huh? Really?
He got okay. A gold. He got a few gold records on the wall.
Yeah.
Where your platinum at?
Where's your platinum plaques at? Show me your platinum, and we can talk. I believe that hip hop is going to come around. I believe that we're going to get back to, you know, what it is. It's just a season, and you know the mumble. It's the mumble time. I mean, you know, Future and all those guys, you know, made it popular, and you know, I believe it's going to come back around to the real battling, the real lyric, you know, the corrupt, the lyrical assassin. I mean, I like hip hop like that. Where you're telling me something, and it just, oh, my mind is going. I just heard your bars, and oh God, it's good. Now these kids, they're just going, you know, whatever they're saying. I'm like, but that was not even a bar. What did you just say? Like, that don't even make no sense.
Which was why it was important for the Locks and the Dipset versus the Beef successful, like the way it was, because now it set the bar to where we're coming back to proper MC.
Yeah.
And seeing Jada Kiss get his flowers is a beautiful thing.
Jada Kiss, he got his roses that day, and he let these young dudes know this is what he do. This is how you come to a party. This is how you come and show up and show out and have them bars, not and really have those bars in your head, not reading from your phone, off your head. Like, come and serve me now. And nobody's going to do that. Nobody's going to go up against him. I was just waiting for one of the young little rappers to say, oh, I can take him on. Okay, well, let's do another versus and see. Let's see.
Man, look.
Now, the only thing they can do is troll. That's all they can do.
Yeah. Oh, and for the trolls, God. The trolls who come out, all the people who have to block themselves at Instagram, I mean, you know, hide behind the keyboard. Like, come out wherever you are. Like, why? You know? Hiding is not cool. Come out.
And one thing about it, I've always said,
I don't know. It's just, I think hip-hop is an evolution. I think it's just going to keep on spinning. One thing for sure, we, Death Row, all of this of what we talked about, you'll be talking about this from generations to generations. We're not going to be about the Yachty's and all them. We're not going to talk about them in 2 generations. They won't know them. I mean, because they haven't done anything for really the culture. I mean, culture itself. Like, what did you do for the culture? Did you cause an impact on this culture? No. So they'll be gone, and we'll remember this part in history, and, you know, I'll forget it. I'm good. I want real hip-hop back.
Yeah. You know, one thing about it, you know, as we close out on it, because we got to say this, shout out to Timbaland and Swiss Beats for coming up with the verses, because not only is that a great event, it's also musical education, and it also shows the younger generation how the elders paved the way in terms of what, I mean, Jada gave a master class from how, because basically, let's just keep it real, y'all. The Locks put on a damn stage show, which was excellent. They gave a real show. And Dipset, it's like those guys, it's like you know, you've got to come out there, you got to be prepared, because when you're at Madison Square Garden in front of the crowd like they were, I'm like, dude, you gotta present it, you know, come out. It's, you know, and it goes back to the artist today in terms of it. This is your, if you're going to treat it like a job, present it
the
as
preparation
such.
And performance,
yeah.
My brother.
Yeah.
That's what you had to learn coming into the game, bro. Like, you could tell who was seasoned.
Yeah,
you could tell who was already seasoned, because those guys came from under Puffy, and Puffy had, you know, when you coming from under Puff, you're going to have to really be on your A game. It's the same way when you even look at guys like Snoop and Dre when he performs, and even the Dog Pound.
Yeah.
They came under Suge. You come from under the umbrellas where you had to compete for your spot.
Yeah. Yep. And
yeah,
and it's a lot of people that got kicked off. I mean, you know, that famous Red Room. It was a lot of people that came in there that showed their expertise. They never made the cut.
And even with the Locks and Puffy, even though they had their differences, Jada said Puffy called them and was like, "This is how y'all win it." Puffy told them, "Do your mixtape material, do freestyles." He's like, "Some of that stuff will crush them just alone." And
right.
They did it, and it was but that era, even with what was going on with Death Row, Bad Boy, you both collectively did something in terms of defining an era. For that, we cannot thank you enough.
T-Max.
This has been –
T-Max, I got to chime in on this before I would like – because, this is a prime example of performance being very important. Now,
go ahead.
I don't know if Kenya was there that night, but were you over there at the House of Blues where Pop performed?
Yep, I was trying. Somebody had footage of that, and I was on stage, and I've been, you know me. I move my way everywhere. She'll tell me I can go, I'm gonna go. And I was there on the side. I remember when they came out, and I kept trying to push myself to the front. I'm like, damn, I gotta get up here. But yeah, that performance was a legendary performance.
Reason why I bring that up is because I look at the performances because, you know, I pay attention to that. Yeah, that's what makes a star. And I'm thinking they had Snoop as, you know, as mainly the face, but Tupac was the opening act. Tupac came through, opened it up, and just killed the shit. Just took the crowd away.
Yeah.
So Snoop had to come out more aggressive. And Snoop came out more aggressive. I ain't never even seen Snoop.
Yeah.
But usually Snoop come in with the laid-back performances and all that, but he came more aggressive. So I was like, wow, these guys are really competing for that number one spot. That shows, that makes the music even greater.
Yeah, I mean, Pop pushed it to another level. I mean, when he came in, you know, he made everybody step up to that, to the plate, you know, and really push harder. Because he was giving it to everybody, so you had to. If you didn't want to be forgotten, then you had stepped up. And that, I just think about that night. I'm like, damn, you know, that was the Outlaws, how young they were and how hungry they were. I mean, just everybody, God, legendary, right?
It was,
yeah.
And I mean, when you
look, I still
at
got
it.
The DVD. I got the hard copy of it.
Yeah, Hot came and he took. That's his stage presence, man. It was nobody that could fuck with him that night. That was his House of Blues. That was his. He owned that night.
And I mean, this is Pop, you know, coming in after pretty much, you know, after he gets with Death Row. But I tell people, and I guess that's the thing, because much to the chagrin of people, although Pac is one of my favorite rappers, he's not my favorite rapper personally in terms of, from that level, but in terms of it, he's one of my favorites. My all-time favorite is Kool G Rap. But what Pac did, he bought an attitude, he bought a presence. And I guess I get annoyed when people talk about how they're Pac fans. I'm like, okay, name Pac's album. And then do me one better. Name three songs off of that first album. I can do it. You know what I'm saying? You know, but a lot of people really don't know Pac until after, you know, he did Me Against the World. And I'm like, it was a great album, one of the all-time great albums. I'm like, You know, I'm like, did y'all listen strictly for my niggas? Did you listen to Tupacalypse Now? Did you listen to When My Homie Calls? Did you listen to Temptation? Did you listen to Trapped? You know, I mean, you know, I'm like, this is, you know, like, you know, but he's missed today. He is so missed.
30 years later, 30 years later, he's still making an impact.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
you, if you look on, like, Art of Dialogue every week, and it's just, I guess I'm always chiming in on it because, you know, I've always got to put my two cents in there if I feel like somebody's, you know, disrespecting him. So many people will come out saying, oh, I was going to be a passenger in the car. Yeah, they called me.
Yeah,
because
they talk about that.
Like, really? You were never going to be a passenger in nobody. You weren't even up at Death Row's offices. You weren't even at, I said, everybody just said anything has never been up to Club 662. I said, well, where were you? Ever. I mean, ever.
Yeah.
Next thing I'm telling you, I told T-Max this. I said, next thing you know, you're going to see Hulk Hogan. He's going to have a story.
Yeah. I'm just like, everybody got a story. They were supposed to ride in the car with him. I'm like, he was friends with that person? Like, I had never seen any of these people that are saying that up at Death Row, any of the offices, any of them. Mm-mm. Not one office. I have not seen anybody, any of them, up at the office ever, hanging out. I mean,
they weren't on Wilshire. You know. They were not at Wilshire.
Yeah. not at the Wilshire office, because it was the first office was 10900 Wilshire, and then they moved down to Wilshire San Vicente. That's the second office. So I'm like, where were you? I mean, shit.
Oh,
like,
they gonna give you the districts. They gonna tell you that their mind was foggy.
Yeah, because I'm like, dang. I said everybody waits 25 years later to start saying they were there and all that, and I get it. Somebody had made a comment, well, people just want to get along. They want to be get along now. I'm like, but get along and tell the truth. Like, don't get along and lie. I mean,
don't be capping. I'm like, y'all want on Wilshire? We're going to make a song. Y'all want on Wilshire?
It's like, yo, now you bad. It's getting to that point where people just want to attach themselves to history. You know how many people that we heard talk about, yeah, I talked to Pop that night. I was in Tyson fight that night. Hey, nigga, you was locked up. We got your transcript.
Yeah, but you know how it goes.
One time, man.
That's how legends do it. Kenga, this has been, oh my God, this has been so much fun.
Yeah, I think her call got dropped, man, but I'm gonna tell her after we get off the air to thank her.
Yes. King, this is one of our best shows.
Oh yeah, man. Oh yeah, and you know what? It's gonna be more to come. It's gonna get scarier. So we about to dip up out of here before they go ahead and shut us up. So hopefully we'll see y'all again this Friday. Same time, same channel, you dig? Big shout out
God
to Kenya. Thank
y'all.
You.
Yeah. Yes, man. God bless everyone listening. You know, the East and West Coast, man. You know, 213 to the 718, man. You know, all around. You know, we love y'all. Thank you again. We see y'all again Friday. And we out. Peace.
Y'all.